ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Hi, it's Sam Hawley from ABC News Daily, the podcast that brings you one big story affecting your world each weekday in just 15 minutes.
And what have we seen from Optus in response to these things? A pattern. It is a game of corporate shirking of responsibility that I personally find has kind of a yuck factor.
Join me for ABC News Daily. Find it on the ABC Listen app.
So I read this article this week in The Atlantic. It began like this. All of my relationships live, at least in part, in my phone, where they are forced to share space with everything else that happens there. Lately, the feeling creeping up on me is that the pieces of my relationships that exist on that screen seem less and less distinguishable from all the other content I consume there. So going on later to give an example, this was from The Atlantic, by the way. The posts from my friends and family are still there, but they're absorbed into the flow of brain rot and advertising. Here, an ad for washable ballet flats. There's a picture of my friend's baby, then a baby I don't know performing some meme-worthy antic, followed by a reel about how millennials are lame for wearing high-waisted jeans. A video of my friend looking hot in high-waisted jeans, an ad for trendy jeans, SponCon for weight loss drugs so you can fit into your jeans from high school that are suddenly trendy again. All of it passively consumed. All of it scrolled on by. What do you reckon?
It rings true for the experience of social media, certainly for me, and I know for you.
Mm.
But I also found myself wondering about this writer's ability to curate a social environment. That's what was lacking for me in this article, because you sent it to me and you asked me what I thought.
Right? Yeah, yeah.
I had a read and I thought, this feels like a generational problem.
Mm. I've got thoughts. I'm Julia Baird.
And I'm Jeremy Fernandez. We're in Sydney on Gadigal land, and this is Not Stupid, where we discuss the news in your feeds and the stuff that's grabbing your attention in real life or in social media.
Yeah.
Now, a little later, we're talking a few weeks ago, Jules, about cleaners and how they seem to just
because
know
there
things.
Was a, I was going to say Randy, it's probably not the right word. There was a certain Peruvian bishop whose cleaner passed forward some evidence of his multiple affairs.
So we put the call out to our audience and said, hey, tell us your stories about discovering things.
Mm-hmm.
And boy, did we get some stories, girls.
Okay, to this piece in The Atlantic. So her point is really about, I mean, it's called the great relationship flattening, that everything is happening in the same jumble on our phones. She calls them little mating calls of pings and buzzers. So you can get updates from people. You can get alerts you never asked for from certain corporations. And it all kind of merges together where it's like an entertainment hub. And it's harder to pick out things from people we love. We don't go to the post box anymore, Jez, for letters. Mind you, when you did,
it
was
all
mixed
these
in.
Days anyway.
So who wants to go to the post box?
Exactly.
Junk mail and bills. Social media, but worse.
Look, I sort of read this article, right, and I thought, I actually went looking up the author.
Yeah.
And I found her Instagram account.
Yeah,
and
her name is?
And she's clearly, Julie Beck, she's younger than me.
Yep.
And I wondered if that's part of the issue here, because she would be more likely to be a digital native.
Mm.
So back in my day, we had real life friends, right?
Yeah.
And so I've been part of this generation.
Sweet.
But I've been part of this generation where we have seen over time, the internet didn't exist when I was a child, but moving to a more social presence and seeing what that transition is like. I don't know how you do this, but I curate certain platforms for certain things.
Well, I think I'm more severe than you. Like, I don't like any notifications for anything.
Same. Yeah. No.
Nothing.
Nothing. No notifications, except for like things like WhatsApp group chats. But I don't subscribe, see, to like news services on WhatsApp. News services are strictly for certain platforms.
Yeah. When I go to look at the news.
Yep.
Yep.
Yep. And then things like Instagram is like a public-facing things and also things that I might be interested in buying, maybe. Mm. It's an entertainment hub. But I felt like Julie Beck's issue, not to diagnose her with anything.
Julie.
You need to curate better, is my take. you need to have certain spaces that are reserved for certain things. But do you remember the time, like years ago, when things like Facebook was first starting?
Back in that day, yes.
And it was just our friends on that thing, right?
Oh,
there was
yeah.
very little.
Yeah.
That was boring.
Yeah.
You know, our friends posting the most mundane things.
Oh,
like,
my gosh.
You know,
people would write
their noodles for lunch.
Yeah. Like one sentence thing went
yeah.
to the park.
Or like a really cryptic, or, you know, people who don't know should stay out of my business. Just hashtag just saying.
I have the wrong friends.
I didn't miss
have enough,
those days.
Like, passive aggressive bitchiness on there. You know who you are.
Yeah, that's right.
Look, I do, but I think for me, when I read this, I'm interested in that flattening and whether it does replace seeing people IRL. We know that.
Yeah.
For me, it's more like a centrifugal force. It just pulls me in. So I've found myself repeatedly, even this week I've noticed, because I've been trying to rest and read and do some other things, I go, oh, wait a minute, I need to get back to this person. And I pick my phone up. I don't know what happens, but I'm suddenly back on Instagram.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. And scrolling through strangers' feeds,
yeah,
right?
And then whatever, yeah. whatever. And then I go, wait a minute, what was I here for? And it was to text a person. And that has happened to me repeatedly.
And then, if I can bear witness, you send them a meme.
Oh, my God, that's the problem. I'm like, oh, Jez would love that. Oh, here's one for Mads. Okay, oh, this could be one for the show. No, it's true. But then we are still seeing each other in real life. I was listening to a Zadie Smith interview. She's got a book of essays out at the moment. She was interviewed by David Remnick from The New Yorker. Oh, my gosh. Let me just tell you the way he described her, because I wrote this down, because it. I was like, if you were an author, you would just curl up and say, my life is done. He said, the editor of The New Yorker, David Remnick, calls her a blessing, not merely to The New Yorker, but to language itself. Whoa. Anyway, she's brilliant.
Right.
And she's not on any of, she doesn't have an iPhone.
Right.
And for years she's been saying this is all about attention. And when she was doing it, when she first wrote this piece on Facebook, she says she went into one of her university classes that she was teaching, and they're all like patting her like, oh, poor Nana, like can't cope with the new world of
the
Facebook
technology,
kind of
right.
thing. Yeah. But now she says what she's saying, she doesn't feel so alone anymore. And what she sees it as, a vast, like, experiment in mind control for entire generations. Yeah, because they want every second
right.
of our time. Every second of our time. There is not a moment that they don't want us on there doing things. And I know that, again, this is not a common thing. People get very alarmed. People lament it all the time. But I think we know it to be a really true problem.
Mm. There was an interesting quote in this article in The Atlantic,
yeah.
Quoting Kyle Chaker, who's incidentally also from The New Yorker.
Yeah.
And he poses this question, if there's no guarantee that our friends will ever see what we post,
yeah.
then what is the incentive to keep doing it? I thought that was a really interesting thing.
Oh, the posting
thing. Like, what,
ennui thing.
What? Yeah.
Like, because what's why? Happening with algorithms what? Now, we used to be able to go onto Facebook and I'd be, although I weirdly would see the same people all the time, which weren't necessarily my closest friends. It was just someone that I met 10 years ago. I used to work with a newspaper or whatever. You knew you would see it. Like there wasn't, the algorithm wasn't so tricky now. And right now my friends can post things. It won't necessarily come up for me.
Mm.
And I do think there's a lot of people going, wait a minute, I'm continually just creating content for someone else to make profit from.
But it's interesting, isn't it? Because I have this experience where there are some friends like you, will send me something
yep.
and then we will have an interaction in real life or in social media
yep.
about it.
Yeah.
There's another friend whom I'm very fond of who posts stuff and I write back and say, oh, this reminds me of da-da-da-da. All I get is a little love heart. There's no interaction. And so we don't have control as social media users of how the other person is using the platform. They may actually just be using it as a broadcast platform.
That's the point that they're making,
yeah.
right?
So
that it's changing to broadcasting and it's increasingly irrelevant whether or not you interact with it. They just want you to keep scrolling. So what does that actually mean when for our relationships with other people?
It reminds me of how during COVID, you know, things were by nature forced digitally online.
Yeah.
And I thought of pub choir because pub choir was a thing before COVID came around, but really took off when it became couch choir and people were joining from home.
Yeah.
And you would think that that would dull the energy of what that interaction, that sort of virtual gathering meant.
Yes.
But it was actually very precious. And when
it was very precious when we were all stuck at home.
But it was a digital, it was a kind of flattening, right? Because it took place in that same space, as Julie Beck argues, in that same space where you get your ads and your notifications all your other distractions. Yeah, yeah. But it actually turned into something really beautiful. So I think there's an element of goodwill, of good faith in engaging with something like that to say, actually, you've got to respond. You've got to sing back. You've got to interact with other people. You've got to listen to make this experience valuable.
And as wonderful as that was, and of course it took off around the world, as you've said, it doesn't compare to standing there at one of those actual concerts, one of those pub choirs when you can feel people physically around you. I don't know. Jez, I think this is something that I'm actually honestly never going to stop thinking about. There's like a piece in The Guardian which was based on a book calling This is the Age of Intimacy Famine, where we interact with our phones rather than our loved ones. And that is true. We're spending more time with these glowing squares than we are face-to-face with people. And what will that mean? We know we talk about ChatGPT. Have you noticed since we did it, not that we're anywhere near the first to do it, I'm not saying that, but since we started talking about counselling and ChatGPT, how many stories and pieces there have been on how seductive it is and how destructive it is of actual relationships, and the fact that people have a robot 24/7 available to be kind and nice and judicious and all the things that you need to be apparently to sustain a relationship.
Do you feel, as this article argues, that we are being rewired by the experience of this?
Yes, and we're being rewired away from people. And it's not for our own benefit at all. And, you know, it was like we spoke about that article by Derek Thompson, which was about the people, it's voluntary solitude, what a lot of what we mistake for loneliness. And they might go hand in hand is people saying, it's so nice to be at home. Now, I've got all my tech, I've got my windows to the outside world.
I might be one of those people sometimes. Same. I love it.
I love getting home after like just some like big event or big thing on and just sinking down with my devices.
Yes.
It's something incredibly comforting. But if you stay there and you're there day after day, and if you're not meeting with other people, I'll tell you another example from the Zadie Smith thing. She's like, a lot of this is very class oriented, which is what we forget. Now, we know that all the Silicon Valley guys that created this stuff are like, my children won't. They'll have nannies that have them out there doing origami, I don't know, whatever, right? They don't let them near phones. But Zadie, and you know, middle-class kids or wealthier kids can be like, oh, yeah, I'm going to detox. I've heard something. My parents have told me about this. She said that her mother did social work in some of the less resourced areas or more disadvantaged areas in, I think it was London. And what she would notice is she used to go in and there was a cacophony of sound. Around dinner time, there'd be people talking, they'd be at the dinner, they'd be back and forth, back and forth. Now she goes into the same houses and there's silence.
Oh, because everyone's on their own device.
They're segregated and they're on their screens.
Right.
I do think we are consenting to this mass experiment.
This reminds me of when you went away recently. You were in Europe and you just put your phone down, didn't you? And you described, this is images played in my mind over and over again. You described a breeze going through your mind.
Yeah. And then you had that when you were in India.
Yeah, yeah. To a lesser degree, I think I was tied to my phone a little bit more. I kind of get a bit, I use my phone as a sort of a navigating device, a device to connect with other people, a device to kind of give me reassurance.
Yeah.
And sometimes to calm me as well.
Right.
If I'm feeling a bit stressed out.
How do you think it calms you?
Well, I think if I'm kind of, if my mind's racing, sometimes at 3:30 in the morning, often at 3:30 in the morning, I'll pick up my phone and I will scroll through something and it would just kind of break the circuit a little bit to allow me to go back to sleep. Now, I know that's probably not very helpful or healthy, but I find it useful in that moment.
Yeah. I think that's really interesting that it's calming. I mean, we can't, that's the problem. We can't be entirely negative about it. I'm very worried about it and I'm really worried about the number of things I was reading something else the other day about how the more AI is becoming more sophisticated and more intelligent, the poorer we are with the use of our brains. Mm. We're becoming less intelligent. We're reading less. We're relying on robots more. Why are you laughing?
I'm laughing because I came across, this reminds me of an article I came across this week that poses the question, is homework dead because of AI? 100%. those days when we used to like go to encyclopedias, books piled up on the table, and you'd be writing your lines out.
Have you ever had a kid explain to you what brain rot is?
Oh, yeah. Word of the year last year, wasn't it?
Was Oxford it? Dictionary, was it? Yeah. It was in shitification.
No. Oh, no. Yeah. I think Oxford Dictionary Word of the Year last year.
But isn't it weird? I've had younger people explain this to me, what it is, but it actually is a thing. This actually is, your brain is getting mushy, is it not?
I don't know. I feel a bit judged
by
that.
I'm not talking about you, Jez.
No.
Personally. No, I mean, like, but it's not ironic that we have, like, this actual syndrome of people keep saying, you don't understand, it's by watching just stupid things that mean absolutely nothing.
Yeah.
At the same time that we're having this discussion about literacy, numeracy rates going down quite substantially.
100%. You're absolutely right about that. I agree with that.
And what do we do about that? And where's that kind of coming from?
Whose job is that to fix, right? Is that
and then what, AI is just here and that's
it? Yeah.
Anyway, I'm being very alarmist today.
I'm still doing the dishes. Damn it.
I want it to do my housework and stay away from my desk.
Exactly.
Thank you very much. I don't know, Jez. I mean, there's obviously no simple answer to this. But I do think that it's worth thinking about leaning against the instinct to connect only online. There's some people I really simply just want to connect with online. There's this guy.
Can't take them in real life.
Can't handle it. 5 minutes, I'm out. No, actually, and there's some people I'm friends with just digitally.
Yeah.
There's a bloke who I consider a close friend. He's a Greek Orthodox priest who once wrote me about a column I wrote on silence at Newsweek. And we correspond all the time. He's in Boston. We've never actually met.
I've got friends like that too. Isn't it weird?
Right?
Is that a product of our jobs that you kind of have people in distant places and people with really profound stories that you keep in touch with? It was a guy I connected with going back more than a decade now. It was going through a really bad time mental health-wise.
Yeah.
We've become friends almost our entire relationship. We've since met in person.
Yeah.
Almost our entire relationship.
Digital.
Is digital.
Yeah. So I think those things
are profound conversations too, a profound connection.
Yes, and a real one.
Yeah.
So I think those things are worth kind of preserving. But I think once we start to lean towards silence in our homes and disembodied relationships, I genuinely think we need to think about that. Okay, so Jez, a few weeks back we were talking about the Peruvian bishop who had like more than a dozen lovers who ended up fighting each other.
And whom Pope Leo has heard about.
Yeah, he's been informed. And there was a cleaning lady who gave evidence. And from what I could read between the lines, is she was quite stroppy about it. She gave evidence about the sheets, women's hair in the shower, and very unfortunately for her and the bishop in question, he sent her intimate images.
What, by accident? Oh, my goodness.
So that probably, yeah. Mate, don't muck around with the cleaner, I think, was what we got from
that. They know everything.
And so we asked if anyone had any feedback and we were not disappointed.
That's right. So we won't name this particular writer just in case, but she writes that, love listening to the show, Jules, at midnight when I'm getting my baby back to sleep.
Aww.
She says, I laughed listening to Julia mention legs in the air.
Oh, and that was thought, it. He had a restaurant called Legs in the Air.
And thought of one of my first jobs when I was at uni. I'd been doing a bit of babysitting for local families and the woman across the road pulled me aside one day and asked if I'd be interested in doing some additional work while her kids were at school. She gave me a spare key for her house, showed me how to use her fancy continuous steam iron and how to work the Foxtel remote. She also asked me not to mention it to her husband because she felt a bit guilty about outsourcing some of her housework as a stay-at-home mum. Fair enough, I thought.
Yeah. Whatever you need to do to get by.
That's right. On Tuesdays and Thursdays, I would sit on my deck doing my uni work and wait to see her husband's car leave the driveway, shortly followed by her car.
Mm-hmm.
Her husband off to work and she was off to her tennis lesson. I'd trot over the road with my key and iron her husband's shirts. This went on for a year or two until I eventually moved away. Years later, my dad mentioned that he'd seen her at his tennis club playing a social game. I remarked that she must be quite good after years of lessons, to which he responded that there was no way on earth that this woman had had tennis lessons in her life because she was that bad at tennis. With a few more years under my belt, I could see my parents watching the cogs turning. as I realised I'd helped facilitate this woman's extramarital tennis lessons for a year. For years.
And coming home to the freshly ironed shirts. Done. Do you know what, though? I think she's probably right, but I have a little bit of sympathy with this because I had years of tennis lessons, Jez. Were you, witness me? Were you to witness me on a court now, you would not believe that was the case.
How are you with an iron, though?
Equally terrible. So who knows? Could be lack of talent, but yes, that is an awesome
that's a
scenario.
Good story.
That is a great story. That woman had it kind of all sorted out. Okay, we've got another one. We heard from Julie who said this didn't happen to her, but a primary teacher colleague who had a grade 3 student report to the class during show and tell that we got a new car last night. Dad and mum stayed up all night painting it and put on new number plates. Great reveal.
Oh, from the mouths of babes.
Exactly.
We also heard from a friend of the program, Darren Saunders, who filled in for me, Jules, on an episode of Not Stupid while I was in India. And he wrote this. He said, I've worked on projects trying to understand wicked problems and harmful behaviours in a variety of contexts, corporate, government, education, industry, all over the world. One thing I've learned, Darren says, is that if you really want to know what's going on in any organizational workplace, you talk to the quiet people, hint, hint, the cleaners, the ones who go about their job largely unnoticed, under the radar, the cleaners, drivers, security guards. They see everything. They observe patterns and details that most people don't. And because they're quiet and unnoticed, the more important people forget they're around and drop their guard. That rings absolutely true.
Let that be a lesson to everyone listening to this podcast.
Jules, it's time for Pick of the Week.
Yes.
Do you know how many fans of the show specifically write into us
about Pick of the
Week,
bail
us up on the street and say, Pick of the Week, loved it this week. So it's a high stakes gamble these days
because
we are working so hard to find a good story to tell you just to lift the mood after we, you know, kind of had a bit of a chat, sometimes a bit heavy.
Gosh, I'm feeling the pressure now.
But, you know, Jude wrote to us a few weeks ago and made us a little kind of music sting.
Loved it.
To go at the top of the segment.
Perfect.
And then Boyd got in touch and he's made us this.
This is the most beautiful, believe me, the most beautiful pick of the week, folks. Tremendous.
Of course he's got a beautiful pick of the week. More beautiful than yours, Jules.
The most beautiful you've ever heard. The best podcast in the world, in fact, Jules. The beautiful and the biggest. The bravest.
That was very well done. Thank you, Boyd. So what have you got for me?
Okay. I've got a tale of contrast this week because, you know, I've been trying to like rest, read, whatever. And I've been watching Mob War, Philadelphia versus the Mafia.
Okay.
Which I always find strangely peaceful watching watching Mafia stories. I don't know why. As you know, I binged the Sopranos.
In a former life.
So in the 1990s in Philadelphia, there was a big contest between two rival factions. Mm-hmm. And one was John Stanford, Sicilian old guard. And then we had the Young Turks, the kind of vibrant Joey Molino and his gang. And they were at each other for control of Philadelphia's streets.
West Side Story vibes, I feel.
Yeah. And it's also about the FBI trying to track them down. And it's so old school. I mean, they had to put wires into buildings, and they're always, you know, in the thick of night, and they're always worried about getting trapped. The surveillance videos were so blurry, you couldn't see whose faces it was. Like, so they got those stories as they were trying to track down these two rival factions. And I actually really loved it. And these guys kind of became local celebrities. And Joe Molino has always denied being involved in the Mafia, was done for trafficking because most of them are in jail.
So these are real life characters.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. I went to Molino, I found Joe Molino's podcast. And he was like, they say Trump's a king. Trump's a king. He's working his balls off. Very pro-Trump is Joe Molino. Right. Interesting. Anyway, there are some of the most farcical stories in there. There's a guy there called John Veazey. Classic thug. He's like, you want me to kill him? I'll kill him. Like, How much? Like, just give me a gun. Like, he's literally just will do whatever is needed of him at this particular time. Veezy tries to kill Joey Molino, manages to kill his best mate, does his shooting, and then takes off in this car and is like, oh, no, we've got to get rid of the car. Normally you would take it away, and as our third grader told us, put on new number plate.
That's right.
Dissemble the whole
Shades
thing.
Of the color.
No, he decides we're going to burn it. So they're burning it, and as they're burning it, he realizes, oh, no, there's coins in the middle of the seat, front seat, and he thinks there could be fingerprints on the coins, goes in to get the coins, his hand's on fire. He's like, oh, no, because he can't go to hospital and his hand's all been burnt off.
Yeah.
And he's like, far out, and he's going, it's starting to go black, but I can't go to hospital, so I decide I would burn it again and then make sure the neighbor would see me so I could go to hospital. So he gets his, he decides he'll pull out his barbecue at home. Pours lighter fluid on it and he's calling out to the neighbor. The neighbor,
perverse.
The neighbor comes and he's like, the neighbor finally sees it. So he goes off to hospital where there are waiting policemen for anyone that comes in with burns. And he's like, well, I just said I had, my neighbor saw it. It was, you know, they're like, what kind of barbecue have you got? And he's like, electric. Don't. And then he's like, I never said I was a good criminal. I never even said I was great at any of this. Anyway, it's just like those kind of weird farcical stories. You know what I've been mixing it with? A very tender tale.
Oh, good.
By Chloe Dalton called Raising Hair. And it's about a woman who, during COVID, kind of, it's not befriends or adopts, but takes into her house a hare.
Oh.
And it's out in the English countryside. It kind of forms, has this relationship with it. She doesn't want to domesticate it. She doesn't want to change its life in any way, but it ends up kind of being part of the house and her and the way she, it changes the way she pays attention to the world is kind of amazing by watching the changes in this, in its habits, in its ears and the way it bounces and its patterns. And do you know that? But then she goes through all the myths there were about them being witch-like or stupid, like Hare and the Tortoise or wily or evil. But no one has really studied them up close sufficiently to understand it. And to now, I reckon this is going to be one of the defining. And it's just written in such a gorgeous way. I loved it. So my friend James Woodford once wrote a book about the definitive study on wombats, which was by a 12-year-old. This is called The Secret Life of Wombats, by a 12-year-old boy who was living in the boarding house at Treetops. And at night he would creep out with his little torches and his pen and his paper and go into wombat burrows.
Wow.
And he would record the way they grunted, the way they moved, what they kind
just
of
to
did,
study
what
them.
They said. He was just so fascinated with them. And to date, that remains the outstanding study of them. So anyway, if anyone wants like just respite from it all, and they can't watch too many mafia. You know, they're tired of their people getting shot in broad daylight. Then I would really recommend it. It seems to so fundamentally change the way. And she was a political advisor, and she was in a very active, hustly kind of culture. So it's beautiful. Raising Hair.
Nice one. I love it.
Yeah. What have you got?
So a little news story from a remote beach in Western Australia this past week. You know, when I was a kid, I was led to believe that treasure maps and letters in a bottle were real and would happen to me all the time.
Yeah.
I would go to the beach and look
for them,
for messages in a bottle. I would possibly send out a few of my own. I used to draw treasure maps. Anyway, a woman named Deborah in Western Australia on a remote beach called Wharton Beach, which is, if you picture where Margaret River is, halfway between Margaret River and the South Australian border in WA.
Okay.
So super, super remote on the Great Australian Bight.
Yeah.
Deborah goes to the beach with a family to do a local cleanup, pick up rubbish. Lovely thing to do. They found a bottle with two letters inside, written by two soldiers. One was written by Private Malcolm Alexander Neville of Wilkawat, South Australia. It appears to have been written while he was enlisted to serve in World War I on the 15th of August, 1916. And Malcolm Neville writes to his mother on the 15th of August, 1916, "Dear Mother, having a real good time. Food is real good so far, with the exception of one meal, which we buried at sea, accompanied by a mouth organ band. They had a sense of humour about it. The dear old Ballarat, which I assume is the ship they were on, is heaving and rolling in the Great Australian Bight. But we're happy as Larry, your loving son, Malcolm. So it seems that he's written this letter to his mother, put it in a bottle, and thrown it overboard. Oh. And it's landed on this remote beach.
That's incredible.
And what seems to have happened is this bottle wasn't at sea for very long in the Bight, washed up to shore maybe in the space of a month, and has been sitting in the sand for more than 100 years, waiting to be discovered.
Is that true?
Yeah. So an oceanography professor at UWA, University of Western Australia, said this was the most likely scenario because the bottle was discovered not far from where the ship would have been sailing across the Great Australian Bight on the way to France. So Malcolm Neville, sadly, didn't return from the war. He was killed in action at the age of just 28. Now, there was another letter in the bottle from another soldier, another seaman who was on his way to Europe as well, William Kirk Harley. He did survive the war, returned to Australia. His mother had died some years earlier, so he had no other family. So he just addressed his letter to whomever discovered the bottle. But Deborah, who found the bottle on the beach, has now managed to contact the families of both these men to try to reunite the letters with their families.
Incredible.
And Private Harley's granddaughter, the one who did survive, she told the ABC that the family's absolutely stunned. It really feels like a miracle, and we do very much feel like our grandfather has reached out to us from the grave. It's a lovely story, isn't it? This is one of my favourite genres of storytelling, as I keep saying, letters from the past.
Yeah, incredible.
And they talk about the optimism, the good nature, the character of these men.
So what was in the second one? Do we know about this?
We don't know what was in the second one. I couldn't find a copy of that particular letter.
Yeah. Wow.
But yeah.
I want to know what was in the meal that was buried at sea.
I mean,
that
like,
would
you
have
know,
had to have been bad.
Kudos to the chef, you know, trying to cook
trying
a
to
meal
crank it out.
At sea on a rolling ship.
Yeah.
You know, spending several months at sea, that would be pretty tough. So, look, one or two bad meals, fair enough. They had a sense of humour about it to give it a ceremony and say goodbye.
And also the way so many soldiers were trying to be really positive for their families and stuff. Oh, it's not too bad.
Happy as Larry.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a gorgeous story. What a great find. Oh, my gosh.
Yeah. I'm still waiting for my treasure map, though.
Just keep looking. Maybe we can put one out. Probably come straight back to us. You know, I once found, I think it was like a shilling in my backyard in Canberra when I was like 7 years old, and I was like, what is this magical coin? And I was convinced it was like ancient, which it obviously it was, and not a currency I was familiar with. I remember showing it to my family and they go, yeah, nah. There is something about finding something from another era.
Yes.
In your home, in the wild, that can really be kind of mind-blowing. And it just reminds you also of the history of like the area you live in. If anyone has anything that they've found anywhere really that has taken them back to the past and provided a memory of a past or a forgotten history, you can email us.
notstupid@abc.net.au. We'd love to hear from you.
We'd love that. Our producers are Cinema Nippard and Madeline Jenner.
We love them.
We love them very much.
It's great to see you, Jules.
You too.
Nice to catch up. See
you next week.